long until somebody was interested in this kind of material, until the day came when everybody was interested in it. You know, it's a wonderful thing, having been thrown out with no job, hunting my own way. I found things that other people were going to need when they lost their way, too. The saying a friend of mine has given me for letting me know when you are in late middle age is, you've got to the top of the ladder and found it's against the wrong wall. Well, I think I've found what it is you need to break through that wall. This is one of the delights of my experience. Zimmer, in relation to the perilous bed in the Sir Gawain story, asked, what's the meaning of an adventure of this kind? He asked, what is the masculine experience of the feminine temperament when it does not seem to have any rationale about it at all? Just be patient. Have patience, patience, and endure. And finally, he says, all the blessings of womanhood will be yours. This is something I kept in mind on one occasion. I was writing a great book on Indian art, a big 2-volume work based on Zimmer's posthumous work, The Art of Indian Asia. I had collected almost all the pictures necessary, but there were about 4 pictures that I couldn't find. But I knew they would be in the file of the Indian art historian Ananda K. Kumaraswamy, who had died a couple of years before. So I phoned his widow and said, I wonder if I can come up and look through the doctor's file and see if I can get a couple of pictures. Come on up, she said. So up I went one hot summer day in Boston, in Cambridge. I was admitted to the library where the pictures were. There was a huge mass of pictures, but I thought it wouldn't have taken more than an hour or so to go through them all and find the 4 that I knew were there, and they were there. Just as anyone who listens to the muse will hear, you can write out of your own intention or out of inspiration. There is such a thing. It comes up and talks. And those who have heard deeply the rhythms and hymns of the gods, the words of the gods, can recite those hymns in such a way that the gods will be attracted.
Joseph Campbell, Esalen, 1983.
So I sit down and I start going through the pictures, and she comes in after about half an hour and she says, oh, it's kind of hot. Wouldn't you like a little orange juice or something like that? I said, okay. So she sat down, and a conversation developed that went on for about an hour and a half, and then she left me to go on with the pictures. I was just getting into it again when she came in and said, you know, I think it's about dinner time. So I said, all right. We had dinner, and that brought us on into the evening, and I'm going on, and she said, Joe, it will be perfectly all right. You can spend the night here and just sleep on the couch there. It'll be perfectly okay. For 3 days, this went on. And I just said to myself the whole time, here's the perilous bed, and I'm going to stick it out. The superintendent thought we were having an affair, and, well, anyhow, I got the pictures. So this is a little example of how valuable mythological information is in life situations.
Brown. Can you give us a picture of what it would have been like to be Joe Campbell working on all these manuscripts during those years?
I was teaching at the time, and the Sarah Lawrence teaching was a full day. It wasn't just a class and you're off. The full-time jobs were 4 full days a week. When I began writing, I took a 3-quarter schedule and taught for 3 days a week, and then I had 4 days for my writing. That was the balance. Then, of course, in the summer holidays, I had nothing but the writing. In the years from the time we'd published A Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake in 1944 until I retired from Sarah Lawrence, I published 15 mighty volumes, big volumes. You can get a lot of work done if you just stay with it and are excited, and it's play instead of work. I'm rather pleased with that record, actually. The writing went on. I took the job of editing Zimmer, and at the same time, my Swami friend, Swami Nikalananda, asked me to help him with a translation from Bengali of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, a great big book here on my shelf somewhere. So I was working day and night. I would write one book in the morning, one in the afternoon, and one in the evening. Actually, there were 3 things going at a time there sometimes.
Still another inspiration of Zimmer's was the idea of including, along with Maud Oakes's sand paintings and her transcripts of Jeff King's account of the Navajo ceremonial, a scholarly and entertaining commentary on Navajo myth written by his pupil Joseph Campbell from the viewpoint of comparative mythology. He was destined, it appeared, to encounter the Balingan series. William McGuire, Balingan, An Adventure in Collecting the Past.
The first book that the Balingan Foundation brought out was a study of a Navajo war ceremonial. Zimmer had recommended that I should write the introduction and commentary and edit the book, so that was another of my jobs. It was a real season of writing, and very, very exciting, and wonderful, wonderful material. And whether it was Finnegan's Wake, or the Navajo material, or the Hindu material, or Heinrich Zimmer's, it was all the same material. That was when I realized, and nobody can tell me anything differently, that there's one mythology in the world. It has been inflected in various cultures in terms of their historical and social circumstances and needs and particular local ethic systems, but it's one mythology. Historians and ethnologists are interested in the differences of mythologies and religious systems of the world, and one can study the mythologies and philosophies of the world with an accent on these differences. On the other hand, the problem emerges of bastions' elementary ideas. Why are they everywhere? This is a psychological problem, and it's a problem that separates us in our discussion of the comparative forms from the whole research having to do with differences. What happened in the West, following the period of Aristotle particularly, was a gradual attack on mythological ideas, so that criticism in the West tended to separate itself from the elementary ideas. However, there is also an undercurrent throughout Western thinking. It's associated with Gnosticism, alchemy, and many of the discredited manners of thought that carries on this interest in what might be called the perennial. I'm thinking of the perennial philosophy as it has been expounded particularly by Ananda K. Kumaraswamy, and picked up, I think it was during the 1940s, by Aldous Huxley in that work of his, The Perennial Philosophy. I'm thinking of this as the translation into verbal discourse of the implications of the mythic images, and that's why the same ideas can be found in the mystical philosophies throughout the world. The continuities that we can recognize in myth come over into philosophy, and the basic idea of the philosophy is that deities are symbolic personifications of the very images that are of yourself. And these energies that are of yourself are the energies of the universe. And so the God is out there, and the God is in here. The kingdom of heaven is within you, yes, but it's also everywhere. Now, just as the idea of deity in these perennial traditions is greatly different from our idea of deity, so does the idea of consciousness differ. In speaking of deities in the terms that are proper to these mythologically grounded traditions, I say that the deity is a personification of the energy. It's a personification of an energy that informs life, all life, your life, the world's life. And the nature of the personification will be determined by historical circumstances. The personification is folk, the energy is human, and so deities proceed from the energies, and they are the messengers and vehicles, so to say, of the energies. And there's that wonderful passage in the Chandogya Upanishad. Worship this god, worship that god, one god after another. Those who follow this law do not know. Because the source of the gods is in your own heart. Follow the footsteps to that center and know that you are that which the gods are born on. Dream, vision, God, the gods of heaven and hell are what might be called the cosmic aspect of the dream. And the dream is the personal aspect of the myth. Dream and myth are of the same order, and you and your God are one. This is you and your dream God, and your God isn't my God, so don't try to push it on me. Everyone has his own deity and consciousness. When you contemplate the mandala, you are harmonized inside. The religious symbols are harmonizing powers. They help. That's the whole sense of mythology, to help you harmonize your individual life with the life of society.
Joseph Campbell, Mythos 2, The Shaping of the Eastern Tradition.
And this is what is known as the perennial philosophy. Now, myth comes in the same zone as dream, and this is the zone of what I would call the wisdom body. When you go to sleep, it's the body that's talking, and what it is moved by are energies that it does not control. These are the energies that control the body. They come in from the great biological ground, whatever it may be, protoplasm. They are there. They are energies, and they are matters of consciousness. But we also have in this body this affair up here, the head, and it has a system of thinking of its own, and that's a whole manner of consciousness that stems from the headset, and it is different in its knowledge from that of the body. When a baby is born, it knows just what to do with its mother's body. It is ready for the environment into which it is put. It doesn't have to be instructed. These things happen, and this is the work of the wisdom body. That same wisdom brought the little thing into form in its mother's body. It was shaped by these energies that lie in us and of which we are the carnal manifestation. This wisdom of the dream, wisdom of the vision, is the wisdom, then, of the perennial philosophy. So that's what came of that. I'm writing all the time now. The real sorrow is that it's cut down on my reading time. There's still a lot to learn.
Brown, over the course of your long career, Joe, what has been the most satisfying aspect of your work?
For me, one of the most exciting and really moving things about mythology is this universality of certain things. It becomes particularly striking when you turn, let's say, from some very simple people like the Pygmies of the Congo, and then go to another very simple people like the Yagan or Ona of Tierra del Fuego, and find the same motifs coming along there. It's not so surprising when you are in the field, for example, of any of the great high culture systems, where we know that there has been great trade and diffusion of techniques and everything else from one place to another. But this other matter, you just wonder whether people have carried from primordial times, you know, from the very beginning, motifs of this kind. One that I find most recurrent is of the men's secret society, men's secret rites, which usually involves some kind of bull roarer, a noise-making machine, a horn of some kind. There's a woo-hoo-hoo, and this is kept hidden in the woods. Women aren't supposed to know anything about it. Then the men bring it out, and they're going to have some ceremony, and the women are supposed to run away and hide and not see it. In some of the cases, the men become very brutal to any woman who does see it. This we find among the Pygmies of the Congo, and we find it again down in the rainforests of Brazil. The same kind of themes occur in Tierra del Fuego. One explanation that I've recently heard from some people that have been working in the Brazilian rainforest is that the idea of magic power, which adheres in the horns, is originally associated with women. We see that with the goddess Circe in the Odyssey, who had the magic power, and the man just had the physical power. The little legend that one finds in three or four of these places, or perhaps all of them, is of the men having stolen from the women the knowledge of the power of magic, and they are now keeping it from the women. Now, we don't often hear from the women's side because the male anthropologists don't get in touch with their actual women's thinking. But there is a couple who were studying the Barasana people in Brazil, a man and his wife, and she studied with the women. What I got from her learning was that the women are actually protecting their power against contamination by the men's power when they go and hide. The idea is that of women having power, the power in their body, the magic of their body, and men having to gain power. Now, the sign of the women's power is menstruation. It is there that the woman is taken over by a power, namely the power of nature, biology. And the men are treated in their initiations brutally, so that they too will open up. The men's instruments are equivalent to the women's menstruation. That is to say, something transcendent of the intentions of the individual is moving in. It's at that field of the overtaking of the individual by mythic energy or a biological energy, any kind of energy, but at the overtaking is the point where ritual comes in and mythic forms.
Kennard, How do you explain the similarity of image and ritual in so many cultures? Are we all one humankind, really? High water. The world is full of biological inequities, but I do think that there are things that make for a kind of spiritual unity. But I think the notion has overtaken us to such a degree that we are beginning to confuse conformity and equality. That's a dreadful mistake, I think. Another form of Western imperialism. I certainly agree with Campbell that we all have a touch of that orrenda, that flame within us that is all the same fire. But what interests me is the ways in which that fire, those different images, is cast upon the world in which we live. Gilliman. With all we know of the structure of the brain, regardless of where the neurophysiologist cuts, there is no evidence that the fundamental wiring of the brain is different, whether you were born as a Hottentot, Melanesian, or Caucasian, from one place or another. The wiring of the brain is absolutely the same. High water. I think there's no question that the murals of the Dreamtime people of Australia and those of Altamira have absolutely nothing in common. The appearance is superficial, not fundamental. When we're looking at early art, we're looking at it superficially, not fundamentally. Because I think the differences begin to occur at a very early time between cultures.
Well, there are certain basic biological experiences that people have to undergo. For instance, in most culture circumstances, the first subject after an individual is born is the mother's body. And the whole system of references of the female body is pretty consistent throughout the mythologies of the world. And you have culture transformations. For instance, you have a people who are a hunting and gathering people, and then come people who are planting. The position of the female in relation to the productivity of the earth will change, and the mythology will change, and the imaging will change. But there is that basic thing. Particularly in the initiation of young boys, one of the problems is to disengage the boy's libido from the mother's body. This is undertaken in the boy's initiation rites by various means in various cultures, but it's the same problem that all are facing. In the first 12 years of a human being's life, he or she is in a position of dependency on authority. Then the whole psychology is that of respect for authority, expectation of approval, disapproval, all that kind of thing. One of the functions of the rituals, again, is to kill that infantile ego. Then you have a death-rebirth motif. So the individual falls into the ground of his own being and comes out an adult, a responsible adult, who's undergone certain transformations. The way the body is mutilated will change from one people to another, but the mutilation of the body goes on. Then you have another situation where the person is being disengaged from the society and moving into old age. There is another constant situation that the human being has to face. These represent constants. It's not always easy to recognize that these constants are modified in their manifestation, what I called when I was quoting Adolf Bastian, the difference between the elementary idea, the universal motif or form, and its local manifestation. The local manifestation will change enormously when you move, let's say, from an Arctic people to a people in the jungle, or from a very simple gathering tribe to the Persian Empire. The imagery is going to change a lot. And much of the conflict that you recognize between two tribes in the Andes that are very close together is the result of background experiences they brought in from elsewhere. They're living close together, but the same culture form meets them, and then they transform it in their own utilization.
Audience question. I'm curious about the title of your book, Myths to Live By. What myths can we live by today? And what realm of life can myth really apply to us on a workable, everyday level? And how can myths be used to manipulate other people's lives or your own life for better or for worse? I think I've missed the point somewhere.
Learning how to manipulate people by myth is something I am not very much interested in. But the person in most recent times who was most successful in this was Hitler. He also knew how to handle a ritual. I have a couple of Dutch friends who were in concentration camps, and when Hitler was to give a speech in the neighborhood where their place was, They were brought out and had to stand at attention while he gave his speech. And one of them told me that he had all he could do to keep his right hand from going up and saying Heil. The power of a well-constructed ritual to move you from some centers that are beyond those of your personal, intentional control is terrific. We've lost all sense of that. We just don't know anything about that. But here comes a man with a genius for that kind of thing, and look what happens. With respect to yourself, Myths to Live By was based on a series of 25 or so lectures I gave over the course of many years, 1958 to 71, at the Cooper Union Forum in New York City. They were dealing with subjects that had been proposed to me by Johnson Fairchild, the man directing that series. They were all subjects that did have relevance to people's lives at that time. That was a long time ago. I have forgotten even what the chapters of the book are, but I can remember that there was a problem of mythology in relation to love, mythology in relation to war, mythology in relation to the transformations of puberty and all that kind of thing. There is plenty of mythological material round about. We're living in a period that I regard as a kind of period of the terminal moraine of mythology. It's as though a lot of mythological rubbish is all around. Mythologies that built civilizations and are no longer working in that way are just in rubble all around us. So an individual who puts himself to the task of activating his imaginative life, the life that springs from inside, not from response to outside information and commands, that person can find stimulation in this wonderful literature that is pouring into the libraries. Now the world is full of these wonderful things again. So there is no rule. An individual has to find what electrifies and enlivens his own heart and wakes him.
Audience question. Then you should actually try and follow the poetic or spiritual feelings that you feel welling up within yourself?
I think that the world of the arts and literature, what we call the liberal arts, is the world in which to find all this. One has to pursue something like that. My hope for the present book is that its ancient art of Scheherazade, which has already charmed us, may so amplify our experience of the world that, seeing ourselves in perspective, some of us shall wish to rejoin the human race. Then, indeed, the reading of the complete 1001 Nights will have been our death as tyrant and refreshment as man.
Joseph Campbell, Introduction to The Portable Arabian Nights.
Now, what a religion does in an Orthodox church for 1 hour or so a week is that one goes and puts oneself in an environment that is supposed to awake that system again. Then you go out and do the chores, and you go back to church again, or you're supposed to say your prayers in the morning and evening, which means putting yourself in touch with those centers. But if the religion hasn't put you in touch with those centers, it's somebody else's religion, really. And, well, then you're cut off. And that's one of our problems.
Brown. Recently on the talk show circuit, you had an ordeal while you were launching The Way of Animal Powers.
You mean the metaphor story?
Brown. Yes. That was a fascinating vignette that sounded as if it helped to inspire subsequent work.
Sure, I'd love to tell that story. A simple realization came to me last year with respect to this whole problem of the function and relevance of myth to life. When The Way of Animal Powers was published, the publisher sent me on a publicity tour. It's the worst kind of tour to go on because you're talking with people who don't know anything about the subject that you've devoted the book to. And the first question they would ask normally is, what is a myth? Finally, I had thought of the definition that I thought would hold them. Of course, I knew that nobody knew what it was anyhow, but it would sound like a definition. And so, toward the end of this tour, I came to, I won't say what city it was in or who it was, but it was a talk show, 1/2 hour, live on radio. And I walked into the room, and the red light is not on, so I can have a little conversation. And the first thing this young man sitting across the table says to me is, I'm tough, he says. I'll put it right to you, no fooling, he says. I've studied law. So, all right, that's okay with me. Then the red light goes on and he starts out with this popular idea. He says, myth is a lie. A myth is a lie, isn't it? I said, No, you must talk about a mythology, a whole mythology by which people live. A mythology is an organization of symbolic narratives and images that are metaphorical of the possibilities of human experience and fulfillment in a given society at a given time. Of course, that was out of the window already. It's a lie. It's a metaphor. It's a lie. About 5 minutes to go, I realized this young man does not know what a metaphor is. So I felt I could be tough too, you know. I've got him in a hammerlock, you might say, and he's not going to get out. I said, no, I'm telling you that myths are metaphors. Give me an example of a metaphor. You give me an example of a metaphor, he says. I taught school for 38 years, so I said, no, I'm asking the questions this time. Give me an example of a metaphor. Well, the poor man fell apart. I mean, I felt ashamed. You don't do things like this to people. Nietzsche has a saying in, I think it's Thus Spake Zarathustra, or The Will to Power, about the pale criminal, the one who has the courage of the knife, but not of the blood. And now I had no courage to face what I had done to this young man on his show, live to his public. The show was in his name. He fell apart and he said, I don't know what to do. Wait a minute. Then he comes up from the floor, we now have about a minute and a half or 2 minutes to go, and says, I'll try. He says, so-and-so runs very fast. People say he runs like a deer. I said, that's not the metaphor. Tick, tick, tick goes the clock. The metaphor is, so-and-so is a deer. That's a lie, he said. That's a metaphor, I said. That's the end of the show. And that got into me. It is so simple. People say they believe in God. God is a metaphor for a mystery that absolutely transcends all human categories of thought, even the categories of being and non-being. Those are categories of thought. I mean, it's as simple as that. It depends on how much you want to think about it, whether it's putting you in touch with a mystery that is the ground of your own being. If it isn't, well, it's a lie. So half the people in the world are religious people who think that their metaphors are facts. Those are what we call theists. The other half are people who know that the metaphors are not facts, and so they're lies. Those are the atheists. I had a fantastic experience with Martin Buber. He was lecturing in New York to a group of about this size, a series of 3 Wednesday evenings. He was an eloquent man. The first evening, he was talking about God, and it dawned on me I didn't know what he was talking about. Was he talking about the mystery that now lies behind the galaxies and the subatomic particles? Or was he talking about one or other period in the development of Yahweh in the Old Testament? Or was he talking about someone with whom he was having a personal conversation? He stopped at one moment and said, "It pains me to speak of God in the third person." When I told this to Gershom Scholem, he said, sometimes he goes too far. So I'm sitting there, and I raised my hand, and he very politely said, what is it? And I said, there's a word being used here this evening that I'm not understanding. And he said, what is that word? And I said, God. You don't understand what God means? I don't understand what you mean by God. You tell us God has hidden his face. I've just come from India, where people are experiencing God's face all the time. It was as though I'd hit him with a brick. He said, do you mean to compare? That's monotheism. We've got it. No one else has it. And then the next week, this wonderful little man, he's marvelous. He's saying very nasty things about the Phoenicians because they're killing their eldest sons for Moloch, sacrificing their eldest sons to Moloch. Terrible thing to do. 15 minutes later, he gets around to Abraham, about to sacrifice Isaac. And now, this is the greatest act anybody in the world had ever given himself to. This is the key act indicating what a wonderful man Abraham was. And so, I couldn't help it. I raised my hand again and I said, Dr. Buber, how does one distinguish between the divine and a diabolical invitation? He said, what do you mean by that? I said, 15 minutes ago, you were excoriating the Phoenicians for sacrificing their eldest sons to a deity. Now you're praising Abraham above all living for having to do the same thing. Now comes the answer. We, capital W, believe that God, capital G, spoke to Abraham. That's his answer. So where are you? This is the problem in dealing with mythology in a monotheistic community. It's not myth, it's fact. This is the concretization of a symbol, and it's losing the message in the symbol. You've lost the message. All you've got is a symbol. And so everybody who says, I and the Father are one, or as the Muslim mystic Al-Halaj said, I and my beloved are one, gets crucified. I think it was Al-Halaj who said the function in the Orthodox community is to give the mystic his desire, namely union with his God. Kill him, he's joined then. Liebestod, the love death. You're united with the beloved. This is a tremendous subject, and it's played a loud tune through the centuries. There are a number of people who have burned to death for celebrating their identity with the divine. Then you cross Suez into the Orient, and the whole goal of religion is to realize that you are one with that which you seek to know. You are it. So there you have the difference between religions of identification and religions of relationship. Identification with the divine, relationship with the divine. A man spoke to me the other day, a very intelligent man, a man who was a man of considerable dignity in our literary world, an agnostic. He asked, "Are you possibly an agnostic?" I said, "I know too much to be an agnostic. What I know is that all of these images are metaphors. And they're metaphors for what? A metaphor has a connotation, and the mythic metaphors have connotations of the spiritual powers within the individual. And when one is preaching religion, if you're not preaching the connotation of the metaphor, you're preaching pseudo-history or sociology or something of that kind. So there's very little true religion in the world. Well, what could I do? I could only write another book. So I interrupted the work on my big historical atlas of world mythology to write another book, which should come out someday, hopefully soon.
Brown, is that how the inner reaches of outer space came about?
You know, when you write a book, you get it off your chest and you somehow forget what's in it. I'm not sure I can tell you. Very well. What it is that I have put into that book has to do with describing how the metaphors are used. I have found, or had known, a Navajo sand painting that in its symbology duplicated almost point for point the symbology of the Hindu Kundalini Yoga. Now, these come from two totally different parts of the world. There cannot have been any diffusion or any influence whatsoever. They represent a symbology of the psychology of the human system in symbolic terms. The Navajo understand it symbolically, and they tell you how to participate in it, and how the symbols actually work upon you. Our highest God is our highest obstruction. It represents the consummation of the highest thoughts and feelings that you can have. Go past that. Meister Eckhart says, the ultimate leave-taking is the leave-taking of God for God, that is to say, the folk God for God, that is to say, the elementary idea.
Joseph Campbell, Mythos.
The first big chapter deals with the inner reaches of outer space. I use the moonshots and all that as my key. You get a picture of the cosmos as we now have it, with hundreds of thousands of galaxies and each galaxy as big as the Milky Way. Hundreds of light years of distance. Then you come to the myth of the ascension of Jesus to heaven and of the assumption of the Virgin. Now, either you throw it out and say it's a lie, or you say it's symbolic of something. And what it is symbolic of is this flight to inner space. And it's rendered as outward, but you're going to the place from where life came, your own deep ground of being. So I deal with the interpretation of mythic images in that sense. The introduction of the book, which I call Myth and the Body, picks up and makes fundamental my basic feeling that myth is a function of biology. It speaks of the energies that move the consciousness. They're all determined by the organs of the body. They do not all have the same intentions, so there are conflicts and dissonances. But myth has to do with the harmonization of one's consciousness in relation to the ground of being in nature, in the body, which is itself a manifestation of a mystery. It's a big subject. As you turn to it and touch any aspect of it, it just opens out and offers new mysteries, provided you follow it in terms of connotations instead of simply denotations. The denotations just don't work, that's all. And I think religious people know that they don't work, and that's why they're so damned deliberate and dogmatic about you having to believe what I believe, because if you don't, then perhaps I'm wrong. They just don't know how to read the symbols. This is the whole thing in my own life in relating to the Catholic religion, which I've been brought up in. All the meditations have to do with something that happened 2,000 years ago, somewhere else to somebody else. Unless those can be read as metaphorical of what ought to happen to me, that I ought to die and resurrect, die to my ego and resurrect to my divinity, it doesn't work. Then the last chapter, the one I regard as the culminating one in the book, was inspired by a remark from my wife Jean. One day when we were talking about things like this, she said, "The way of the mystic and the way of the artist are very much alike, except that the mystic doesn't have the craft." I use that as the key here for paralleling the two ways of the mystical life and the artist's life. The artist with a craft remains in touch with the world. The mystic can spin off and lose touch, and frequently does. And so it seems to be that the art is the higher form. I thought Jean put her finger right on it. Mythology is an organization of symbolic images and narratives metaphorical of the possibilities and fulfillment in a given culture in a given time. Mythology is a metaphor. God, angels, purgatory, these are metaphors.
Joseph Campbell, interviewed in the New York Times, February 1985. Chapter 6. The Magic Flight.
If the hero in his triumph wins the blessing of the goddess or the god, and is then explicitly commissioned to return to the world with some elixir for the restoration of society, the final stage of his adventure is supported by all the powers of his supernatural patron. On the other hand, if the trophy has been attained against the opposition of its guardian, or if the hero's wish to return to the world has been resented by the gods or demons, then the last stage of the mythological round becomes a lively, often comical pursuit. This flight may be complicated by marvels of magical obstruction and evasion.
Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. For 2 years in the mid-1950s, Joseph Campbell taught courses in Oriental philosophy at the State Department in Washington, D.C. The strong reception he received from the diplomats he was helping prepare for overseas assignments, combined with his own year of study abroad in Asia, made it clear to Campbell that he had something vital to teach people other than students and scholars. His next clue came in 1968, when Michael Murphy invited him to teach at Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. Over the next 19 years, Campbell co-taught classes there with writer Sam Keen, Tai Chi master Cheng Ling Al Wang, psychologist John Weir Perry, and many others, constantly widening the scope of his approach to mythology. Campbell resumed his travels after retiring from Sarah Lawrence as Professor Emeritus in 1972. Over the next years, he journeyed to Iceland and Turkey, Egypt and Greece, and made a long tour through Southeast Asia. The fourth and final volume of his 20-year project, the four-volume The Masks of God, was published in 1968. It was a study of the historical development of mythology and the religious differences of humankind, designed to complement the Hero with a Thousand Faces portrait of the intriguing correspondences. It was followed 4 years later by Myths to Live By, a collection of his lectures at the Cooper Union Forum in New York, and in the same year he published The Portable Young. In 1974, he published The Mythic Image, the capstone book of the Bollingen series. Brown. You know, Joe, I've driven up and down this Northern California coast with you and had a tremendous time reminiscing as we came down to Carmel, to the nooks and crannies that you had been as a young man. But I've no idea how you got here to Esalen originally.
I guess it was about 16 or 17 years ago, 1968. Alan Watts suggested to Mike Murphy that he ask me to come down here. I think that was about the time that Esalen was beginning. I was flying to Milwaukee, and there was an hour break in San Francisco between my flights. Mike came up there at that time, together with Richard Price, and asked me if I would come down here. All I did was lecture on mythology, right here in this room. This was about all there was at that time. Apparently people liked what I was doing, so I kept coming back.
For more than 20 years, Joseph breathed new life into Esalen. Seminar participants, staff, and work scholars alike came away from his seminars like people from revival meetings, inspired by Galahad, Kali, or Hermes, rather than visions of hellfire. No one brought their audiences to their feet like he did. No one in Esalen's history joined enthusiasm, scholarship, and wisdom so fully. Michael Murphy.
But a big advance, a big change came along when Sam Keen came to visit me one time in New York, and we decided we'd do something here together. We had a theory. Sam was very good at finding out where people are when they're stuck, when they're in trouble. I don't think you have to go through a deep psychoanalysis for that. There's just some kind of idea that's blocking you. Remove the idea, the person is released. That's a good mythological principle. In India, demons are simply obstructors of consciousness, those things that block consciousness. We had an idea that Sam would be able, by interviewing people and in dialogue with them, to find where they were stuck, and that I would be able to find and recognize the mythological analog to their problem. It was a nice theory, and nobody was going to get hurt, and it actually worked. We had three or four events that were really spectacular, and that was the first time that I really came to understand the relationship of my scholarship, which was simply about mythology, to actual psychological problems, and it's been going fine ever since.
Brown, it sure has. Brown. As a psychiatrist, I'm particularly curious about your work with John Perry. How did you first meet him?
That was a marvelous meeting. Mike wrote to me one time and said he'd like me to come out and talk with John Perry, a psychiatrist in San Francisco, about schizophrenia. I said, I don't know anything about schizophrenia. He said, well, he'd like to have you give a lecture anyhow. I said, well, how would James Joyce be? And he said, that would be just fine. So I agreed to come out and talk with John Perry, and Perry sent me some of his monographs, his articles on the symbolism of schizophrenia, the sequence with which these images emerge in a patient's mind who's in a deep schizoid crack-up. And it matched the hero with a thousand faces, just like that, step by step. And so there again I came to understand the relationship with something that had been simply a scholarly interest of mine in mythology to actual life problems. And it's been pretty exciting ever since.
Brown, that's really how I got acquainted with you. In the middle of the 1970s, I read a book of yours, Primitive Mythology from The Masks of God, and it sounded like what my patients in psychoanalysis were telling me.
Yes, that's marvelous. Actually, I guess the big crisis in my popular career came in the 1960s when people were taking LSD and my book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, became a kind of mythological roadmap for the hippies.
Kennard, do you remember any people who came up after your lectures and asked you something which made you say to yourself, oh my God, I have 30 seconds to tell them the true meaning of life?
No, I haven't had that problem.
Kennard, do you remember ever going up to somebody and actually asking them?
No, I don't ask questions like that. I'm usually asked. One of the worst things, though, is after having given a lecture and taking questions from the audience, somebody comes up to you afterwards with his whole soul in this thing. That's the hardest thing to handle. Then others are writing PhD theses, and they want specific book references, things like that. Those are the only real annoyances on this job.
Tarnas. So, PhDs and soul searchers. What are some of the PhDs that people are writing? Serious or straight stuff?
Well, you'd be amazed at what people are getting PhDs for writing. I knew a chap who was doing a thesis on the use of semicolons by Milton in his sonnets.
Kennard. And he asked you about that?
No, he told me about that. It's a funny business, actually.
Kennard. Joe, what are some of the more interesting questions that you've heard after your lectures? Did any of the questions people asked you just out of the blue at the end of your lectures ever introduce you to something new?
The most interesting question I ever got was when I was lecturing here at Esalen in the Abraham Maslow room in 1967. Somebody asked, "What about the symbolism of the weight deck of tarot cards?" Well, I hadn't thought about it. I'd seen tarot packs, and I can remember my old master, Heinrich Zimmer, giving lectures on cards, and I remembered a couple of things he'd said. So I said, "Well, give me a tarot pack and let me take it back to my room, and I'll say in the morning what I found." That was a very exciting thing. I had the luck to recognize a couple of sequences there. There is one for the four ages of man, youth, maturity, age, and what Dante calls senility. He also calls it decrepitude. Dante discusses this at length in his Convivio. Then above that I saw another sequence where there was a woman pouring water or something from a blue vessel into a red one, and this was called temperance. And the next one was the devil, hell. And the next was a thunderbolt hitting a tower, the Tower of Destruction, which is the traditional sign for purgatory, you know, the tower of evil being smashed by the thunderbolt of God's destruction of all your tight ego system relationships. And the fourth one was the beginning of life, paradise, the two red vessels being poured out to the world below. Dante's La Vita Nuova, the new life pouring from the physical into the spiritual vessel. Put those four here, put the other four here, and the whole thing fell out into a beautiful system, interpreting the transformation of the psychological relationships through not only the four stages of a lifetime, but also in the shift of accent from purely earthly to high spiritual ideas. The four suits are interesting because this is a medieval pack. The first evidence of the tarot we have is from about 1392, a pack that was made for King Charles I of France. This was shortly after Dante's death, but we are in the same field as Dante. It's also medieval. The four suits are swords, which are the aristocrats, the nobility, cups, which are the clergy of the Catholic Mass, coins, which are the moneyed estate, and batons, or staves, which are of the peasants. Those were the four castes of medieval tradition. Now, there are two stages in a lifetime. One is the stage of entering life, which reaches a climax around 35 or 40, and the second is a stage of leaving life. And the four suits have to do with entering life in one or another of your occupations, whatever your task might be. And then the big set at the end, the honors suit, the major arcana, has to do with the mystical path. It worked out just like that. It was right in front of my face. It was a fascinating experience, the most interesting I have had here.
Kennard. What interests me here is that somebody came up to you and first turned you on to the tarot just by a question. You explained the honors suit, and you explained that it told you where you were in life and so on. So what? Why was that such a turn-on when somebody turned you on to this and you saw where you were in life? Does that affect us now? Why did you get a sudden flash and say to yourself, "Oh, yes"?
It's a pack of cards that's used in fortune-telling, you know, in reading character and so forth. And as it straightened itself out as I saw it there, what it represented was a program for life that derived from European medieval consciousness and actually carried into symbolic form many of the implications of Dante's philosophy. That was the one that really hit me. Dante died in 1321, and the earliest evidence we have of cards of this kind comes from sermons around that date against the cards. And you wonder, why against cards? You find out why when you look this thing over. It's basically agnostic philosophy that's there. To make the point, there's a notion in Orthodox Christianity that the end of the world is coming. This is a mythological symbol, the end of the world, interpreted in terms of the historical event. For the Orthodox Christian, it's got to be a historical event. But mythological symbols do not talk about historical events, they talk about spiritual events. The end of the world is a spiritual event, not a historical one. Now, there's a gospel that's known now as the fifth gospel, the gospel according to Thomas. It was dug up in the Egyptian desert about 1945. Toward the close of that gospel, the disciples asked, "Master, when will the kingdom come?" And the answer Jesus gives there is in great contrast to what you get in Mark 13, where the king was going to come with clouds and all this kind of thing, and wars and everything else. Here, Jesus says, the kingdom will not come by expectation. They will not say, "See here, see there. The kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it." That's what's known as the Hermetic Gnosticism, Bodhi in Sanskrit. Change the perspective of your eyes, and you see the whole world before you now is radiant. Do you see? In this tarot, that's the doctrine that comes out. The last figure, called the world, is the dancing female figure of the alchemists in a mandorla. In the four corners of the cards are the apostles, the signs of the apostles, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In other words, the coming is right here, now, in the world, and not at all something to wait for, not for a historical experience. That's what hit me.
Arian, do you believe in the tarot? You can read the cards, but do you believe what you read when you use them?
No, I don't do anything like that. I just see. I can show you how it works and what a beautiful thing it is.
Arian, but you don't believe that it could tell you anything?
It gives you a program for life, what the concerns are in the different stages of life, and what the spiritually lower and spiritually higher attitudes are toward the experiences of life at different stages. It's a wonderful thing.
Arian, do you feel that you can see the kingdom here?
Sure you can. There was an old preacher back in the Depression, the Deep Depression, Father Divine. He used to give wonderful sermons, you know, and then he'd say, "Can't you see the mystery? Ain't you glad?" And everybody would say, "Yes, Lord." Well, can't you?
Arian, yes, yes, marvelous.
Yes, it's just that you're not taught that this is it. That's the big problem. I don't think there's malice behind it. It's just that this is not an idea that is in our culture history. It's been screened out for one reason or another, and unless you get it, you don't of yourself come to the realization. But just get a little clue, and this tarot is one, and then there's nothing difficult about it.
Arian, you've also said that the tarot was accessible. Was that a threat to the church?
I don't know about that. I don't know what the actual situation was. There are just these few clues, as far as I know, from the 14th century, to let you know that something was coming in. Another thing about this is that a lot of people have the idea it comes from Egypt. It's sheerly medieval. The symbolism is medieval. It's the European idea.
Brown, does this inability to see the kingdom here and now have something to do with our disastrous relationship to nature?
Let's see. There's a trend in our whole religious tradition toward ethical rather than metaphysical insights, you know, good and evil and all that kind of thing. In our tradition, one doesn't trust nature because nature has fallen. There is the God of creation and then a fall, so that life is mixed of good and evil. You can't lean on nature, you're always correcting it. You're always making an ethical standpoint, good against evil, you know. Think of the contrast with Taoism, where you yield to nature and give yourself to nature, or primitive cultures, where people rest well in nature. And it makes for a total transformation of consciousness to realize nature is good. And this is what I felt and learned in Japan. There is a saying in the Shinto religion, the processes of nature cannot be evil. And then you turn to Heraclitus, and Heraclitus says to God, all things are good and right and just, but for some men, some things are right and some are not right. and so metaphysics. Worship, worship, worship. People coming from all over India, a great pilgrimage place. The whole idea of pilgrimage here is translated into a literal, physical act, the pilgrimage of moving into the center of your own heart. It's good to make a pilgrimage if, while you are doing so, you meditate on what you are doing and know that it's into your inward life that you are moving.
Joseph Campbell, Mythos 2, The Shaping of the Eastern Tradition.
Arian, how did you learn this? What happened that showed you?
I was in Japan studying Buddhism and Shinto, 1955, and these things come out in the text. I remember the feeling I had there. What a pleasure it is to be in a place that never heard of the fall. I used to say to my friends, if you are thinking of psychoanalysis, save the money and go to Japan. It clears away an awful lot of rubbish. I just totally fell in love with it. And when you're in love like that, you have no pain.
Favreau, but isn't there society so structured that individually you have a hard time breaking out and being independent?
I don't know the answer to that. I was just there for about 7 months, and I thought it does one no harm to have a structure. At least you keep your agonies to yourself. People smile, whether they're happy or not, and that's very nice. Perhaps a certain amount of individual freedom is not quite desirable. Another wonderful thing is the railroad train. If the train is 2 minutes late, there's a public apology over the public address for being 2 minutes late. When you get on that bullet train, and you're going at, what is it, 150 or 200 miles an hour, something like this, and it's as steady as that, you know? When you get on one of our trains, my God, there's one I took from New York City north to Stamford, and there you are, rattling along, sitting there in the dining car, and when it comes into Stamford, the train tips and everything goes on the floor, and the wonderful old porter comes in and says, every time we come to Stamford, this happens.
Favreau, do you think there is too much freedom in our particular culture?
No, I'm not saying those things. I'm just saying how nice it is to be in Japan. What I learned there is about this trust for nature. You can't tell where art begins in nature and nature leaves off. In Japan, things just override from one to the other, and the temples and shrines, they are always in accord with the local nature. The gardens of Japan are arranged, like the ones in Kyoto, Sanzenin, Kozanji, Ryoanji, among others, so that as you go in the garden, you are climbing up, and suddenly a whole new vista opens. It's arranged so that you get an amplification of consciousness just by experiencing that garden. This union of the spiritual and physical intensity is so great. Now, I was in athletics when I was in college, and a couple of years afterward, too, but it was just athletics. When you go in for karate or something like this, and you realize their spiritual, psychological attitudes, placements, all that, they're so important. Everything works that way in that part of the world. They realize the reference of religion is psychological. What happens to you? As Dr. Daisetsu Suzuki, the Japanese Zen master, once said, this world, with all its faults, all its crime, all its horror, all its banality, all its stupidity, is the golden lotus world. But you have to learn to see it in that dimension.
Joseph Campbell, Myths of Light.
We have the question of what happened in Jerusalem in AD 30. And did it really happen? What's that got to do with anything? There's a marvelous little story that Daisetsu Suzuki, the Zen philosopher, brought up in one of his talks on Zen. He tells of a young man who asks his guru, am I in possession of Buddha consciousness? And the guru says, no. And the young man said, well, I heard that all things are in possession of Buddha consciousness. The stones, the trees, the flowers, the birds, the animals, and all beings. Yes, said the master, you are correct. All things are in possession of Buddha consciousness. The stones, the flowers, the bees, the birds, but not you. Why not me? Because you're asking the question. That is to say, Instead of living in the knowledge of himself from that transcendent source, he's living in the knowledge of himself as a separate unit, and that throws him off. So he isn't living out of his Buddha consciousness. Now that's the trick for the artist, to present his material so that it doesn't put a ring around itself and stand there as separate from you, the observer. And that aha that you get when you see an artwork that really hits you is, I am that. I am the very